Health and Well-Being by Viv Trader. You will hear various experts share their knowledge within health and well-being. This podcast is based on facts and science. With knowledge, you can raise your awareness so that you can make better conscious decisions in your everyday life. Decisions that will benefit your health, the planet, and our future generations.
So today I have the real pleasure of inviting Susan Anderson. Hello, Susan. How are you today?
Hi, how are you?
I am lovely. I'm love having you on board today. We've just been chatting a little bit and I feel so excited to have you here today. Thank you so much for coming.
I'm very happy to be here.
Now, Susan, can you please tell me a little bit about yourself? Who are you?
Well, I'm a psychotherapist who had my own profound abandonment experience, adult abandonment experience. And yet at the time I was a specialist in abandonment. I used to call it separation anxiety. As a therapist, that's what I focused on the most is the underlying feeling of separation anxiety that I thought was at the heart of all distress, you know, all mental illness, all mental distress, all emotional problems that people have. And in the middle of a very, you know, intensive programming with working with parents and children and adults around heartbreak, loss, and abandonment because of the separation anxiety, the love of my life, my marital partner, left me for another woman. And I was so in love with him. And he was in love with me, but it was such an enormous shock that I was practically brought to my knees. And at the time, I was at the top of my career, doing all these programs, helping people with separation anxiety. I immediately changed the word to the word abandonment, because it was that primal to have someone reject me. We'd been together, we built a house together, we were such a couple for 18 years, and wow. He just left out of the clear blue sky for another woman.
You had no idea.
Because it was something in his pattern of behavior that he had done before 18 years earlier. That's how we wound up together. But we were so happy that the pattern didn't repeat itself for 18 years. So I had no idea. So anyway, I was so devastated that I realized that we as a people, as a culture, as human beings, did not really understand what abandonment really was and how you can have an abandonment crisis. I really saw that, because there's so much shame involved with abandonment. It speaks to weakness. And if we have abandonment vulnerability, we're also admitting that we don't feel worthy of connection because we fear being left behind. So it speaks to, and it's universal shame. It speaks to our shame about somehow not being worthy of being kept, not being worthy of being worshipped, not being worthy of being adored, not being enough, having something inherently wrong. It speaks to that universal shame. We all have that, but it's very taboo. It's very deeply buried. So that's why abandonment, in my opinion, at that time, had not been studied or understood. And so I thought, okay, I'm a therapist. I'm kind of a nerd. I like to research things. It's my job. I'm going to find out what this is all about. So that's how I set out to develop, you know, an understanding of what abandonment is. How does it manage to have such a power to reduce a person's self-esteem and leave lasting impact? It's a trauma.
Sorry to interrupt you there. What I'm picking up now is, isn't this evolution, when we lived in villages in the olden days, we had to belong, you know. If you were on the outside, you didn't have food, you didn't get water, you didn't get shelter, you wouldn't survive.
Yes.
So you needed to fit in.
Yes. The ostracized is
yes.
The you know, we used to have ostracization. We still, people get ostracized, but in an informal way. But the fear of being ostracized, being cast out, left behind, meant death. It was a life and death situation. So the stakes of abandonment are life and death. And the brain, which is primitive, you know, the primitive brain, the amygdala, the emotional brain, doesn't, it's the part that has very primal, primitive feelings. So it reacts to abandonment as if it's life and death. I can't live without my partner. I'll die without he emotionally murdered me, or, you know, the references that people make to death and the suicides that follow a lot of, you know, heartbreak and loss and murders. Also, there's a suicide murder thing you hear about, someone being so jealous they shoot their lover's partner and they shoot themselves, they kill their lover. It's not terribly uncommon. So death, what you bring up in being ostracized. As an adult, you can be ostracized. As a child, you can be abandoned. So if you're part of a tribe and you need the tribe to survive, we all really need a tribe. We not just need people, we need kind of a tribe. We need a community, we need other people. But but when we're children, if we don't have a parent, if our parent dies, we can't take care of ourselves, so we can die unless we have a community where somebody picks up. You know, Ingmar Bergman made films where he puts two people on an island somewhere, and they're all alone, living on the island, growing their own vegetables and killing their own animal, trapping their rabbits, and then one of them dies. And the other one has to dig a hole and bury them and then survive completely alone. That's very unusual. Most of us have a tribe, but Ingmar Bergman studied the phenomenon by creating a situation where two people are alone in the world, no tribe. Well, they have a tribe, but they're not with their members, their family, their extended family. And what happens to them? How do they survive the death of one of them? So this is such a deep subject, this abandonment. And, you know, you can be triggered to feel these feelings from very ordinary things. Like, you know, you could be happily married with three children and a lovely life, and everything's fine, but one of your friends dismisses you. Yeah. You're going through a problem, and this friend doesn't really listen the way you listen to her. She doesn't listen to you. Or you feel, you find out that you've been excluded from some event that your friends attended, or you did something really nice and you weren't acknowledged, or you were overlooked. You're very worthwhile and at work, but you don't get the recognition. Little things like that can squeeze that abandonment wound that is so deep within all of us. And you don't necessarily know why your mood changed, why it's upsetting. You might fault yourself and say, I'm so weak, I overreact, what's wrong with me, I'm too emotional. You might do that. You might shame yourself for it. Or you might not notice that you're feeling hurt. You might get defensive and, you know, a little more aggressive and have sort of a counterphobic kind of reaction. But
well, it's super
little
painful being excluded.
Triggered.
Yeah. Yeah. It's super, it's super, super painful.
Yes.
And we all have it, right? No one can escape it.
We all have it. So let's say if you were excluded, you find out there was a gathering, your friends all met for coffee and they didn't say, come on, we're all meeting for, you know, something like that. And it's minor because it might have happened very spontaneously. But nonetheless, it triggers the other thing that we all have universally, which is the shame. So even though the thoughts and the feelings are pretty much unconscious, or they might go so fast we don't recognize that we're feeling them, but it's sort of like, why wasn't I included? I'm not enough. There's something missing. other people like each other more than they like me. And the reason is I don't have enough. I'm not enough. I'm
There's
missing
something wrong
something.
with
I'm
me, or
inadequate. Yes, what's wrong with me? Why me? So even though we might know 10 minutes before this, we might be feeling top of the world, so confident, fully aware of our self-worth, able to dazzle people, but then we get excluded and suddenly I'm not enough. I don't have what it takes. So the reason these little rejections hurt is because they make us feel bad about ourselves. They trigger the shame, which is part of that abandonment wound.
And abandonment comes in many different forms as well. I mean, I lost my mother when I was 12. That was very, very painful. I remember the day when I was told the news that she was passed over. I mean, I had a panic attack. And I felt, how on earth am I going to survive my life now? Who is going to look after me? And so I can totally empathize with the big wound of abandonment. But for me, that was quite extreme. But for other people who doesn't have less of a traumatic experience, how can an abandonment wound surface? How can you get one from your childhood?
I mean, losing your mother at 12 will definitely create the abandonment trauma, because the children who lose their mothers or their fathers, but let's just stick with mothers because the mother is the primary caretaker and usually. But if a child loses its mother, the child doesn't feel special because other children have their mothers and they don't. And there are many reasons why it hurts. You miss the person, there's so the love, the connection. I mean, there are so many reasons why it's painful and why it's a huge adjustment. But one of the many reasons is that you're not special like the other children. They have their mothers. Why not me? How come fate took my mother away, but not everyone's mother? If every single child lost their mother, it would be horrible, but there'd be a community around that, but there isn't. It's a singled out by fate type of situation. You were chosen for this to happen by fate. You know, children have all kinds of magical thinking too that can complicate it further, but there are so many scenarios that lead to abandonment feelings, such as if one of your parents is an alcoholic. It's kind of a chronic, you grow up where your parent is there, but they're really drawn to the alcohol and you come in second. Also, if one of your parents is an alcoholic, you'll be dodging bullets between your parents because it creates tension in the relationship. So the parent who's kind of, getting high or drunk isn't quite available to the other parent either. So not only are you experiencing your own disconnect and disappointment, but you're experiencing your parents' feelings of abandonment because their partner is an alcoholic and they feel abandoned. So you've got double abandonment. You're feeling your mother or your father's abandonment and you're feeling your own. And it's a chronic, because it's not an event that happens once, it's your whole childhood. So a lot of people who with abandonment issues grew up in a family where one parent was an alcoholic or a drug addict or had mental illness or, had a physical illness. And all these things that have such an impact on the family dynamics. Children identify with their surroundings. So if I know a client who's she's a beautiful thing. She's in her 30s. She's very intelligent and has a lovely smile personality. But she grew up in sort of a dysfunctional family. There was fighting, divorce. The mother was dating horrible men, and the house was full of cigarette smoke, and there was poverty. But she was so smart; she got a scholarship to a really great private school for high school. But she felt inadequate compared to the other students. She was probably the best student there, the most popular, the most beautiful. You know, she knocked it out of the park, but she identified with her surroundings, and she knew these other students came from these nice little homes with that were neat and tidy, and there was enough money to go around, and they didn't have to dodge bullets and listen to people having sex, and you know, their homes were different. So even though she knew she was so lucky, she had all of this beauty and intelligence, she felt less than, abandoned.
Yeah, and how did she overcome that? Did you work with her?
Well, okay, I did. All right, how do you overcome this? Well, here's a thing that people don't usually like to hear this at first, but then it makes sense, so I'll explain it. But psychology kind of operates on the principle of catharsis, that if you bring up the feelings and you get rid of them by crying, or by screaming, or by sharing it with someone, and the feelings come to the surface, you'll be a lot better off, which is true. There is some improvement, but with abandonment, there's no boil that bursts like pus. It's not like you have an internal infection and you lance the boil and you get rid of the pus by screaming or crying or talking. Because abandonment is primal. And the, you know, from birth onward, from the birth trauma, you know, onward to all the little things that happen to us that are happy and exciting or disappointing and all the stuff. This is how our brains develop. So the abandonment wound isn't just like a wound that's separate from the, it is part and parcel of the way the emotional brain develops, all the connections and
how the brain fires.
Yes, because the emotional brain, the amygdala, is conditioned by experience. You know, that's how we learn in culture. If we live in a where there are icebergs, we learn not to go too near to the edge. But if we live in a tropical place, we learn to avoid snakes. We learn by fear. It conditions us. And so we are conditioned in so many ways from what happens to us from childhood on. So it isn't like, well, we just have an infection and we lance it and get rid of it. We have to accommodate the abandonment wound and celebrate each person's individual feelings that are internal. Each person has to sort of come to an understanding of what's going on inside without having an unrealistic expectation that they should be able to get rid of the feelings. If they can celebrate the fact that they're vulnerable like everyone else and that we all have feelings, then they can know what their feelings are and they can work with who they really are without feeling any shame for all the fears and the vulnerabilities, but to work with it. And they can then finally create self-love, which is the most nebulous concept in the world. You know, you should love yourself. How do you do that? But begin to tune into this wound and you discover all of the feelings that are there that are not a sign of weakness. They're a sign of being human. Then you can have a real sense of who you are emotionally, and you can have compassion for yourself, self-acceptance. And then you become more connected when you talk to people, and when you're with people, there can be more authenticity and more generosity. I mean, it has so many advantages to be in touch, more expressive, you share, you know, all the good things in people.
Mm-hmm. And then you would say the wiring of the brain, for me, it has taken me a very long time, and I had done massive amounts of work on overcoming my abandonment wounds. But I had to rewire my brain. So things that I had a fear of, I had to face them and tell myself, you can do this, you know, you're better than the fear, you're bigger than the fear. And what's the worst thing that can happen to you? And it's been a slow process, but it's certainly helped me by facing my fears and thinking differently. It's not going to be catastrophic. I'm actually going to manage to do this. I can manage this. I can do this. It's almost like talking to your inner child.
Yes. Well, it is a dialogue with your inner child. That's very much a part of the program of abandonment recovery. But, you know, there's such a thing as post-traumatic growth. So in your case, I'm guessing, this could be wrong, but this is what I'm picking up. I'm guessing that your mother dying was, you know, very painful, as you describe it, and that there was in you some determination. You know, this is not to say that a person should be given extra credit for having it. You're just lucky if you have some determination, some good stuff going on inside of you. Mm-hmm. Some people don't have it. It's not their fault. But anyway, I'm guessing that you had it. Maybe your mother helped you have it. Mm-hmm. But that allowed you to use the sadness and the trauma as an opportunity to gain post-traumatic growth. So you have post-traumatic stress disorder. Well, you have post-traumatic stress, but then you have post-traumatic stress disorder where it lasts a long time. But then you have post-traumatic growth, PTG, and it represents the layers of strength that we develop as a way of accommodating the trauma. So you know how when you break your leg and it's reset, that where the leg was broken, that area has overgrowth. That's the strongest part of your leg. And it's very much like that with trauma, where that break is, as sad as it is, that might be because of the way you handled it and your determination, you might have be that might be your strongest area. Well, or one of your strong areas.
That is very true. I'm very surprised you picked up on that, because I've been in therapy many, many years. Obviously, the first time I went into therapy was when I was 15. And then I've been continuously going through therapy with about 10 years intervals. And pretty much all my psychologists have said to me that I have this ability to turn negative emotions or situations into opportunities. I have this, you know, positive outlook. And I actually think today I'm actually grateful. It sounds horrible, but I'm actually grateful that I lost my mother, because it made me the person I am today. And
yes,
and I've done that big journey of healing and becoming authentic and being real and finding the inner peace and my own, you know, self-love, you know, working on my self-love and building a relationship with myself. So in hindsight, I'm happy that I had to face that enormous amount of pain, because otherwise I wouldn't be where I am today, I think. And
well, you know, we have the image in the United States, we have Abraham Lincoln, who raised himself and educated himself. He was so poor and he became the president, but he's all self-educated, self-made. But we have that image, and I'm sure you have similar kind of image in Sweden. But, you know, you didn't have a mother from 12 on. You were not nowhere near ready to give up having a mother. But you were forced.
Yes.
So you are sort of a self-made person, because you didn't have her there to help you cry on your, you know, you there were so many pieces that were missing. Mm-hmm. So you had to invent yourself. You were at such a critical part of development when you're 12. I mean, you're no longer a child, and you're entering this, whoa, you know, a whole being a woman and all of that. I mean, it's just tremendous. And you did it yourself. You had help. You had other adults, I'm sure. But you had to do it yourself. You had to become a self-made woman, an Abraham Lincoln character. And so you're self-educated. And so I would be sure that, you know, people who know that you have certain things about you that are unique.
Yes.
Because you didn't learn them the easy way. You had to teach them to yourself.
True. Very true. And I have a daughter now. She's turning 12 in October, and I'm looking at her. And I mean, just the thought of her losing me or her mother would be hard.
Imagine.
I mean, now she's when I'm a mother myself, and it is It is
Who
just
would be picking you up from a horseback riding lesson? Who would even get you involved in horseback? Who would even promote that? Yes. Oh, I mean, it must really come home to you how fortunate your daughter is, but how you became who you became.
Yeah, and I'm so self-aware. So I'm now giving her everything I never got. You know, all the security, the safety, the attention, the love. Someone's being present.
Yes.
Someone who's there after school when you're coming home.
Yeah.
I take it for granted sometimes, but it is actually a massive mission. And breaking generational trauma as well, I think.
Yes, it is. It's breaking generational trauma. You get to redo it. And of course, it's very healing for you. Yes, you became your own person and developed strengths, but you know, there's a sadness in there. But as you are able to give that to your daughter, you're kind of giving it to yourself. You're going back almost retroactively, you know, giving what you had needed at 12.
Very, very healing. And we are very,
yes,
very tired.
Very healing.
Yes. It's almost like you're reversing the cycle. It's so what I didn't get, I'm actually getting by giving.
Yes, you're getting it by giving.
Very profound. Now, okay, so Susan, we're talking a lot about what is an outer child. I know you talk a lot about outer child, inner child, and adult.
Well,
where
it's
do you
a
become?
three-part framework. The most important part of the framework really is the dialogue between your adult self, you know, your cognitive adult self, and your inner child, the love. Being able to ask your inner child, what are you feeling? And to keep asking even better questions. Why are you feeling that way? How long have you been feeling that way? What can I do to help you? Oh, you don't trust me. You don't think I really care. You know, a real dialogue where you really give voice to this, you know, personification of your inner child. But in order to allow people to see their inner child as innocent and blameless, you know, that we needed one more voice to blame all the reactive behaviors, the bad habits, the patterns that we learned for many years, you know, the procrastination, the avoidance, the drinking, the overeating, you know, all the stuff that we do to reduce stress and seek pleasure that's automatic. We needed a voice to blame all that on, so that when we say, I love you, to our inner child, we really mean, I love the innocent, emotional, helpless part. But the outer child that does all the bad stuff, well, that's, you know, that's something I want to change. So the three-part framework is the inner child and the adult, who need to be very close. And then there's that rambunctious outer child that acts out, that does stuff like gets attracted to the unavailable, to people who are unavailable, because it's exciting to be chasing someone. Or
well, that's why I did too. I ended up marrying a narcissist, you know.
Yes,
I
being
didn't
attracted
know
to a narcissist.
Yes.
Oh, that's such a pattern that happens as a result of abandonment, because it creates a feeling of wanting something that you can't quite get with a narcissist. You never get what you need. So it repeats that feeling of wanting something, but you can't get it. Wanting your mother, but she died and you can't get her. You know, it repeats that feeling. Wanting, you know, your father to give you approval, but he was too busy, or, you know, whatever your history is. That
oh,
it
true,
repeats that feeling. And so the outer child says, oh, well, let's just keep that going. That's what makes us tick. You know, that's what I'm used to. So the outer child, you know, it's a personification, but you're pretending you have an actual outer child that's like 8 or 9 or 10 or 11, you know, who the outer child is the part that keeps creating patterns and cycles. But if the adult self gets wise and strong and strengthens, you know, the focus, gets focused, and you have focus because you turned your mother's death into a and out of necessity into an opportunity to gain strength. So you do have a strong adult self. But if your adult self gets strong enough, it can say, wait a minute, why am I only attracted to narcissists? What about being attracted to someone who's more like me, who's ready to be very fair and equal and really wants to share? So, you know, once you start to develop the adult self, which is very hard, by the way, but once you do that, you can override all these patterns, not all of them. You can override most of your patterns. You know, you could have a very strong adult self, but you're still going to procrastinate and avoid, and you're still going to watch too much television and scroll through your cell phone, and you're still going to maybe overeat or drink too much or whatever it is. We don't even want to achieve perfection. So we always have some outer child stuff, but we don't want the outer child to set us into patterns that sabotage our future.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of work, but it's doable. You know, I have this whole program of abandonment recovery, which is work intensive. It doesn't happen by some spontaneous, you know, insight.
Yeah.
You have to actually work it. But
I was lucky. I had a spiritual awakening as well. I don't know if you sort of believe in that, but I became very spiritual when I lost my mother as well, because it became natural to me and it gave me strength as well.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I also had a very strong intuition as well, which has been very, very helpful for me, knowing things in advance and yeah, very, very in tune with my spiritual aspect, my soul. And then I woke up again and had a spiritual journey about 6-7 years ago. So I've been peeling the onion.
And oh.
It's been very, very painful at times. But now when I'm almost done, I'm coming out of the phase, you know, I'm stepping into my mission, and I feel so much lighter. I feel such an enormous amount of peace, joy. I can be present. It's been so painful. It's been such a painful process, but it's so worth it. So I can totally empathize with that. There is a light at the end of the tunnel if you're prepared to do the work.
I have to say that if you can have a spiritual awakening of that sort, I don't, you didn't specify, you know, the nature of it or anything. I'm just sort of generally relating to it. I think that's a bonus. That's a plus. Not everybody can do that.
It was a gift.
But it's a gift. It is a gift. I just finished running a workshop this weekend with a lot of people, and some of those people spoke. We addressed the whole group of 40 people, and then we break out into smaller groups. But in the large group, some of the people mentioned that kind of an experience, and it's quite a gift. It really is. So that's wonderful. And you know, being in therapy is also, that's another gift that we can give ourselves, because it is so easy, especially if we have, you know, abandonment issues and we've been through abandonment trauma. It is so easy not to be focused. You go through life in patterns, rote. You know, you don't really know what you're feeling. You don't even know what questions to ask yourself, because you're not focused enough. So you're doing things, you're living, you're having your life, but you're doing it with such a not as conscious as you could be. But the idea is it to be, to actually have a forum to examine your emotions and look at your life. It's that's another gift.
Yeah, and I think to become and reach your full potential as well, for me, I need to put my fear aside to reach my dreams. I can't let the fear hold me back. And naturally, the biggest fear I have is what I need to conquer to reach my dreams. And I think that if you live with a fear and you're not fulfilling your potential, that eats at you every day. You know, you will always feel that feeling that something is missing, and why, and the shame and the guilt and
so. Well, and that fear, you know, I'm sure you've experienced this yourself. We all have a fear of the of abandon. We all have abandonment fear, but we don't know it. Not everyone knows it, but we all have that. But when I tell a group of people, for instance, that we're going to be dealing with abandonment fear, there is fear because people are afraid that it's an abyss and that if they look into that crack, they won't be able to get out. It's the fear that the abandonment wound is deep and cavernous and that it's got sticky stuff at the bottom and it's, the sides are steep and they'll go down there and they won't be able to get out. I might be exaggerating a little bit. Different people have different images. I've heard many of them. Fire is down there. It's endless. It's bottomless. You keep going. There is a fear of addressing the abandonment. There's a fear of going there. But you know what we do? We in the workshop, we sort of like take a fish knife and just get into the gut, and everybody discovers, no, it's not scary down there at all. Mm-hmm. It's real. Mm-hmm. It's emotional, but nothing really bad happens. So all that fear prevented people from going into that. But once they get there, it's a tremendous freeing experience.
Yeah, and have the courage to dare to go there and feel the emotions and deep diving.
It does take courage and trust. It takes a lot of trust. And, you know, where do we get trust from? From our relationship with our mother, really. I mean, we learn that that is real love and that it's always there. And that trust is threatened by if the mother dies. We weren't expecting that. That's not supposed to happen. So we get our trust from that. So to have the trust that, you know, that you'll be able to go into your fears and handle it, it's like you're really on your own. Again, you're having to reinvent yourself around that trust.
And that's why I became so independent as well, I think, early on. And that's, I've always been super independent. And I think that has correlation.
I'm sure.
If we look at abandonment from a male perspective and a female perspective, how do you find from your experience throughout the years, how are men dealing with abandonment wounds compared to women? Are they more open or are they more like?
Well, the only gender difference that I see is that, and this isn't even always true, but women tend to have permission to cry for a longer period of time, and they might have a couple of friends they can cry to. If women might have three or four friends, so they can cry to this person, and then this person gets tired of it, but they have another friend they can, you know, cry to the next friend, and she gets tired. They still have a spare friend, and then by the time they talk to the third person, the first one has calmed down and ready again. So women tend to have, it's not always true though, they tend to have more of a support system. A lot of women don't, but some do, and they're very lucky. Men don't tend to have the support system, and they don't have the patience. Men go through abandonment just like women do. They cry like insanely. They feel completely crazy. They feel weak. They beat themselves up for being so devastated. It's an emotional crisis they can't handle. They want to die. They just can't believe they're in it. So thank God for alcohol or whatever drug they may have, because they can't handle it. They crawl into a hole. And they are not given permission as much by society to cry as much. So they might have a friend, but they don't really want to cry to their friend. They might. See, this is all stereotypic, because there are good men relationships where they can cry, you know, But as a general rule, they might have a friend they can complain to and say, "Oh, I'm so bummed out. I feel like dying. I don't know what I'm going to do." They might have a friend or two they can talk to like that, but not forever. And the abandonment crisis, when you go through a rejection or a breakup, it can go on for months. It's really, really hard to get through. And it can happen to women and they could have each other, but if it happens to men, maybe they don't have as big a support system. But the pain is the same. It's unbelievable pain. You know, I have men and women in my workshops. This time I had like 36 women and 3 men. And at the end of the work, usually there are more, but this time, for some reason, there were only 3 men. At the end, the women said, "Thank you" to the men. "Thank you for being here, because I would have had different experiences, but we didn't. We're all exactly the same." And I get that response a lot.
That is very interesting. So we need to really encourage men to get their support and start.
Yeah, I mean, I know the little bit that I know about culture in Scandinavia, there are group activities and clubs and things that help people stay in contact with each other. We can be so isolated in my culture. We can have people we see that we work with and stuff, but not close and personal. And the more close and personal we can have our relationships with people, the better we are. I mean, it's just better because we can be more authentic and not feel so much shame about our emotions.
And being authentic actually frees you up, and that leads to freedom as well, because you know it firsthand as well, the experience from not being authentic to being authentic, the difference.
Yes. For instance, when I mean, I belong to certain professional organizations where it's not appropriate to walk in talking about my latest problem or, you know, it isn't appropriate. And I'm perfectly comfortable going in sort of like wearing a mask, but I don't enjoy it. I do it. I can do it. I can wear my mask. I'm not putting on an act. I'm just not, you know, expressing my emotions. I'm just going in and, but my greatest satisfaction comes from being really myself and being really honest about what I'm feeling. That's what feels good. And when I run a workshop, we get into that state right away, and people really enjoy that so much because they can really be themselves. If they're talking and they start crying, okay. And if they have a joke, okay, but it comes from, you know, really hanging out and, you know, being with what they're really feeling.
That's where the real connection happens too, and the magic, you know, heart.
Yes,
to
real
heart.
Connection, not just face to face, or it's, and not just sort of being attracted to someone from afar and saying, "Oh, I like that person. I bet this is what," you know, really getting a sharing with somebody.
Open your heart more.
Yes.
All right, time flies. I love talking to you, Susan. Where do you hope we are in 10 years in the world from now in terms of your work?
Well, you know, I'm always trying to let people know about that abandonment recovery is possible, and that they don't have to improve situations in their lives perfectly. They can just make the smallest little improvement and it makes all the difference in the world. We don't have to be perfect. We just need a little connection, a little opening to what we're feeling inside. And if you follow the actual program of abandonment recovery, I want people to know that it's work. They have to be prepared. It's like being in recovery, you know, it's a whole process that they go through, but of course it leads to good outcome. But basically, you know, where I want to be is that the more people around the world understand that they can heal, they can begin to get in touch and begin to develop self-love and self-acceptance.
Mm. Then again, back to self-love. Every single podcast I do, I come back to self-love.
Everything will always. Yes.
Yeah, everything is self-love at the end of the day, right?
At the end of the day, it's self-love based on real self-knowledge, though, really knowing what's in there. What is the self? Because it goes deep.
What is self-love for you, Susan?
It's self-acceptance. It's accepting myself as I am, emotions and all, you know, vulnerabilities and all. And it's an active relationship. It isn't something I take for granted. I don't take for granted that I even know what I'm feeling. I have to ask myself. I have to create a dialogue and say, what are you feeling? And I, much to my surprise, I find out, and then I can really be connected to myself.
So being mindful of yourself every single
Mindful.
day.
Yes.
Thank you so much for coming. I loved
Oh, it
having
was
you
my
here
pleasure.
Today. It was a very lovely conversation. Thank you so much for contributing
Well,
so
thank you
largely.
So much for having me.
I hope you got some valuable information today that will help you increase your health and well-being. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.